Public input. I think we have four people. We have four people. We have four chairs, so I'll call you all up at once, if I may. Irene Martin, Kent Martin, husband and wife, Greg King, and Robert Sudar. You go first, please, Irene.
Commissioners, my name is Irene Martin. First of all, I want to do the fun stuff. My testimony and a couple of invitations are being passed out. One of the invitations is to each of the commissioners plus staff to attend Seafood Legislative Day, February 24th this year, in Olympia. The second group event is the Fisher Poets Gathering in Astoria, Oregon, February 28th and 29th, which consists of fishing people from all over the nation getting together to share poetry, stories, and workshops on environmental and other issues of importance to fisheries. And it's a fun weekend, and it's open to the public. So I'm drawing it to your attention, and I've got the website listed there for further information. The Seafood Legislators Day last year was the first attempt by the Coalition of Coastal Fisheries, which is an umbrella group of commercial and recreational fisheries and others, to familiarize legislators and others with the variety and quality of Washington seafood. I attended, and one of the comments I heard most often was, "Is this caught in Washington or is it imported?" We explained that everything seafood in the room came from Washington waters. And we got overwhelmingly positive responses. There is a market for locally sourced seafood and an opportunity for Washington State to emphasize the outstanding seafood products available locally. I want to direct your attention to issues arising from policy C-3620. I believe that at times the Commission has had a narrow focus on its role in this policy, believing that its recreational customers need to be provided a much larger share of available fish. And you've all heard the arguments pro and con on this issue. However, following Brad Smith's comments about history of the commission, in 1995, Initiative 640, a ballot measure that would have eliminated net fisheries and other commercial fisheries throughout the state, was defeated by a public vote, 57% to 42%. On the same ballot was Referendum 45, which set up, which is now the Fish and Wildlife Commission. And that passed nearly 61% to 39%. I can't think of a better way of determining public intent regarding Washington State's desire for both the Fish and Wildlife Commission, with authority over commercial and recreational fishing, and retaining vital and viable commercial food fisheries in this state. The same voters who supported a Fish and Wildlife Commission also voted to retain and support commercial fisheries by almost the same margin. Finally, in reading through the Big Tent Committee's recommendations and explorations that they're working on with their strategic planning process, first of all, I want to commend them for stepping back to look at the bigger picture. I have two comments on the progress report, and I'll just read the second, if I may. You're looking to regain trust and confidence in WDFW. To reach this, I believe, you'll need to produce the best science and abide by it. Develop your policies after you've done the science, not before. And keep your promises to constituents by using adaptive management and amending your policies when they are clearly not working. The public review process undertaken by the Commission is an approach to adaptive management, with the PRC thoroughly examining policy 3620. And many of us have contributed a great deal of time and effort to this same process. Ending it now or postponing it will not enhance the credibility of the department or the commission. It'll just be repeating mistakes from the past. Thank you.
Commissioner Baker has a question, and then Commissioner McKenzie.
comment, not a question. Thank you, Irene, for bringing up the Fisher Poet Gathering. I just wanted to let fellow commissioners and anybody else who might be listening know that I've attended that in the past, more for the music than anything. It is a wonderful gathering of people of all stripes coming together, and they come up with some pretty darn good music there, and so it's a fun thing to go do, and I would encourage anybody. I'm going to try to go. So just
I'll probably see you there. I plan to be there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would also echo it's a really fantastic festival of a coastal community celebrating fishing. So let me say thank you very much for your powerful testimony here, in particular your paragraph dealing with the 1995 history. That's exceptional analysis. We also got handed out another table here that seemed to be coming along with your testimony, and I wondered if there was a point to this, or if this was really you, or what?
This is him.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, he bought dinner last night.
Yeah, you're up, sir. And I left my credit card there, so retrieve that.
A tragic moment this morning.
The point of what I passed out to give you was to give you an idea with the gillnet in the Zone 4-5 vis-a-vis the other technologies, and the hemorrhage of money out of our fishery because of these experiments. There's a sign on the counter of a business I periodically use in Astoria that says, "I'll believe corporations are people when Texas executes one." I think that's the way a lot of us in the Lower Columbia feel about 3620. The promises of expanded select areas, increased production, and alternative gear have not been kept. Our people have kept their end of the bargain. Some of them believed that Policy 3620 was to be a new era in harvest management and opportunity, that it was not just another tawdry allocation smokescreen. This is why over $1 million worth of alternative gear languishes in Lower Columbia warehouses. All the monitoring strip searches of the gillnet fishery have shown that the rhetoric of curtains of death and kill nets is just that. The imaginary smoke rings of self-appointed waterless gear experts. Selective harvest is as much about absolute numbers of dead fish as it is about percentages of dead fish. Nothing has thus far eclipsed the gillnet because the strategy of when you fish, where you fish, and the gear size you use was ignored in any kind of alternative gear evaluation. Moreover, alternative gears are much more labor and capital intensive. They will not be sustained by low-value clip toolies, a handful of hatchery coho, and largely unmarketable jacks. The ultimate sweet spot of viability, if that is really the goal, will likely be some combination of gears. Kicking the can down the road by postponing or suspending the policy review process is lousy science, inimical to salmon recovery, and just plain dishonest. The policy review needs to continue, and some uncomfortable issues regarding salmon recovery and hatchery surpluses need to be squarely addressed. I don't know if any of you have your finger on what's been happening in these rural communities in both Oregon and Washington. The Timber United thing, what's gone on with the Oregon Commission, whether that then confront with the policy change commissioners and shuffle the cards. The 80-20 split on spring Chinook that precipitates extended closures of the select areas when a northwester, which is the prevailing wind, blows and blows a handful of upriver fish in there, you have to shut it down because they don't have enough impacts. And the sea lions are a good benefit. I'm sure the animal rights folks really love that. I guess I would say, in a word, this ain't Texas. And we need to do something about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Ken. Robert. Greg was before me. I don't want a crowd. Go right down the line.
You're probably wondering what I have to bring today. Rob Studar, by the way, from Longview. After I talk to you practically every time you meet, but I've always got something new I want to talk about. And I want to support the continuation of the PRC process. I went to nearly every meeting that they had. I think I might have missed one, and that was down in Oregon. But I did go to several in Oregon. I think it was an important process. I think the fact that Oregon spent several years, Washington staff spent a year reviewing the policy and showed there were a lot of flaws, just it's the right thing to do, to look at the policy and make corrections. It was what was promised to us in 2013 when it was passed. If you listen to the testimony of the nine commissioners who were there at that meeting in January, they all talked about adaptive management, that there was lots of opportunity to make changes, and the staff report indicates that changes are in order. And that's all we're talking about, making it reasonable. There was a fair amount of conversation yesterday about what sport priority is. I've been going to these meetings for a long time, and I know that north of Falcon for at least 15 years, and sport priority has always been the issue in the Columbia. They've always had more than 50% of the spring Chinook since about maybe 2003 or so. They have the majority of the summer Chinook. We always tried to manage our fall season so that they could get to Labor Day if at all possible. Those were always sport priority issues that we all worked together to achieve. And we actually achieved seasons that were just as good as what you're getting with this policy. If you look at the Oregon staff report, they identify that no days were gained through that. There was also a discussion about what sport priority is. Previously, we were talking about that it was opportunity for sports fishermen. That was what your staff said. And that for commercial fishermen, it's obviously harvest. We're out there trying to catch fish for the marketplace. And the suggestion yesterday that it should be something akin to buying a loaf of bread is just unreasonable. I mean, that's never been the case. It will never be the case. It's about whether or not you can have a chance to go fishing with some sort of chance, obviously, of harvesting something. I don't know if you ever look at this document. It comes out every year. It's the sport fishing report. It's put out by your staff. And if you look at this, like I have, and you look back 20 years or so, year in and year out, approximately 80% of the sports fishermen who get a salmon card don't catch a fish. Approximately 50% of the fish are caught by 2-3% of the people. That, or 2-4% rather. That's year in and year out. It didn't change with the policy, and it doesn't change because our commercial fisheries are not interfering with recreational success. It's in your own document that isn't affected, and I'm at a loss as to what else to tell you about these things. We have a new marketing group that's been set up with the director's help where we talk about commercial fishing throughout the state, trying to advertise it. If we don't have something to sell, it's a wasted effort. The public wants these fish. I can give you 35 plus years of evidence of that in what I've done just as an individual marketer. And so I'm hoping you'll continue this process and get this policy back somewhere in the realm of science and recognize that if there are fish to catch, there should be fish to catch for all user groups, not just for one. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Again today. To your point about the catch information, that's very interesting information to me. And if you're willing to do it, I would suggest, not to say that you're not speaking the truth, but if you could maybe just do a summary. You're very good at this, putting together a little table. And you know, just kind of summarizing the data in the tables and then distribute it to the commission. Yes, that would be helpful and useful information for all.
No, I would be happy to. I mean, I really haven't brought this up because I don't like to get into an argument between user groups on this. It shouldn't be that way, but that is what it keeps devolving into. And I get frustrated when I look at these year after year, and it's the same story. And the impression is that these policies are going to create more opportunity for the recreational angler, and they don't. That isn't how recreational fishing works, and it's just a plain fact of life. And your own staff has the data there, and I'll be glad to share what I put together if you want to see that. No problem. Thank you.
Thank you all, actually, for coming in. I was involved in the discussion yesterday about the recreational priority and what it means, and it just look forward to our discussion today as we move forward on the Columbia River policy. To me, yesterday we were discussing what recreational priority means. We heard a whole bunch of meanings to it. And what I have realized sitting on this commission with our policies is sometimes we have these terms that we repeat and we repeat and we repeat, and they're kind of vague and they're not defined. And that creates a problem for our staff who are trying to implement the policies. To me, that's one of the issues we have with the Columbia River policy and some of our other policies. I hearken to Willapa when we adopted that, and it had recreational policy. And we were all kind of shocked that that was interpreted to mean a four-bag limit. What does it mean? And I think it's incumbent on us, and look forward to our discussion, to be more specific as we have these terms and actually define them to move the policies forward.
You should have gotten a document from me this week that talked about the importance of all of the different seasons important and their importance to our overall industry. And I talked about 2007, which had a run very similar to what we had the last couple of years. On almost every run, it was very similar in numbers. And we were able to fish successfully, and the recreational community had just about as many days to fish as they did last year. It isn't about our opportunity getting in the way of their opportunity. It's about how to manage the runs and so that everybody gets some opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. And then Bryce, as soon as we have an open seat, you can join us, and that'll end the open public comment.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Chair Carpenter, Director Cieswin. First thing I want to do is I want to apologize to the commission for my comments yesterday in the heated Willapa discussion. I want to apologize for that. And I'm here today to tell you just a little bit about myself. My name's Greg King. I live in Lewis County, Washington. I'm a lifelong resident of Washington. I have a wife. I have a daughter. I was member number four of Friends of the Callus back in 1988. And in about 5 years ago, I dedicated myself. Somebody said to me, go to a commission meeting and introduce yourself to the commission and get to know them. They're not bad people, and you're not. And I did that, and I dedicated myself to working with this department, rolling my sleeves up. I spent this week almost every day here in the department. I spent last week over in the ledge in the Capitol trying to get you guys fully funded. We don't have a gillnet problem. We have a production problem. We have predation problems, sea lions and birds. We have a budget problem. We can't raise fish. So I just thought I'd let you guys know a little history about me and what I'm here for, and I've defended some of you on social media, and I gladly would do that again. I'm here to help you guys fix the department and work with the department. I want you guys to know that. I think you guys are a great group of people, and we need more of you. And I think it was Commissioner Kehoe said to me that the more people we have involved in salmon, the better off we are. And I take that to heart. And I don't know which one of that was Commissioner McIsaac or Commissioner McIsaac.
I stole it from him. But
okay, so we'll work around that. But I'm dedicated to getting this thing and stop the user group arguing. I don't want to argue with these guys. I want to sit at the table like we have today and hear what they have to say and hope they can hear what I have to say. And, you know, I've dedicated myself to helping you guys along the way. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments, Greg. Go ahead. Wait 1 second. Mr. Baker was waiting for a question. For Kent Martin first, and then you can.
Well, first off, I want to thank you, Greg, for your apology. It takes courage to do that, and I appreciate it. Apology accepted, at least from me.
Thank you.
Kent, with respect to this document on the different types of gear for the last few years, it's understandable and it's clear from looking at the document that you brought it forward to show the income difference to a fisherman depending on the gear. That's not my question. I think everybody, well, okay, that's still not my question. I am a person, as the commission seems to be, but with our policies, it's very, very interested in coming up with more selective gear. And so my question is pretty simple. As I look down the columns, I see I see some return on beach seines every year except 2016. And in 2016, eight fishers went out and caught one Chinook salmon with beach seines for a value for the fisher per day of $4. That's a very big difference from the other years. And as we are trying to develop alternative gear, and as you say, get your $1 million, which is in some warehouse in the water, what is it about? I'm just interested, what is it about the, what changed? What is it that made that gear ineffective?
Maybe Robert knows more about that specific incident. Part of the problem, and I think a lot of us didn't even think it through, because a lot of us were, I'm still very open to alternative gear. I just want something for our communities, because if something isn't done, your grandkids aren't going to live long enough to see this turn around in terms of attitudes toward resource agencies. But one of the problems is that so much of the alternative gear thought of percentages, a 40% or 35% mortality rate in gill nets. Well, that really says nothing if it's 35% of eight fish. That's the kind of numbers we're talking of. Group B steelhead in that zone, 4 or 5 largemouth fishery. But the problem with traps, seines, and I heard this from Jeremy Jordan, the nymphs guy, is they're totally non-selective. They catch everything. So you got to manually sort. And any time you handle fish, you're going to lose a few of them. And so that the actual numbers of dead fish quite often is higher in some of these alternatives gears because you're handling huge volumes of non-target fish. That's the thing I think that we didn't even think of. But, you know, there's some guys that are, I mean, a couple of guys that I know of that were purse seiners, Jeff Povilite and Marty Culler, they didn't even volunteer to get involved in this alternative gear. They're so angry and bitter, they just feel betrayed.
Yeah, can I just add something? I recall, I don't know whether it was you, Bryce, I don't think so, but I recall somebody, one of the Columbia fishers had taken up the purse seine during the trials that we were doing, and said he actually pulled out, after pulling it out once because it was so full of steelhead. He just said, I got to stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, let me compliment Mr. King on his testimony and his participation. Consistently, you've been one who has been someone who, in this divisive atmosphere that we seem to find ourselves in nationally on so many things, someone who has been striving to bring people together, and your positive attitude is something that I really want to compliment you on. And when I hear you're working across the street with regard to the department's budget and doing all these other positive things, we need more people like you. So thank you. I have a question that Commissioner Baker has spawned on Mr. Martin's table. The lower right-hand corner shows a comparison between the large mesh, if I read it right anyway, a comparison between the large mesh gill net take and the Cathlamet pound net take boiled down to the value per B-run steelhead mortality, if I've got that right. And it seems to show that in 2017, there was more salmon commercial value per B-run steelhead in the large mesh gillnet fishery than in the pound net. And in 2018, it looks like the pound net didn't do too well. And the large mesh gillnet fishery again showed a better salmon per B-run steelhead value. Is that the right way to read those? Is that what you're intending there?
Yeah, I think it's again, it comes down to time, area, and mesh size, which were really never considered, when this whole alternative gear thing. And I think there's probably a place for some of these alternative gears, and they may well become the dominant. But that doesn't mean you have to throw gill nets out. It shows here what the value in that far right corner per B-run steelhead is of the catch. And that's poundage taxes to the department. That's income into the lower river. And if you look also at the value of the fish, the gill net, 9-inch and 8-inch, tends to catch larger fish. That's why steelhead squirt through it. You look at the seines and the traps, they not only catch usually smaller fish, but, they catch a whole batch of jacks, which brings the average down also. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Okay, Bryce. Thank you, Chair Carpenter and Commissioners. I'm Bryce Devine. I'm a Columbia River Commercial Advisor. I'm also on the Alternate Gear Development Panel, and I support the continuance of the PRC. And I wanted to highlight some of the problems that I see with the development of alternative gear. And one, I think we're going about it the same way we did before. There's no real purpose or plan that's well stated. It means a different thing to different people. The different groups see the benefits in different ways. They don't really understand that the purpose, the conservation purpose, is to reduce PHOS. And if you look at it at a mathematical point, if you're going to make a substantial reduction in PHOS, you're going to take the same percentage of hatchery fish. You're also going to handle a like percentage of the wild. They're inseparable. They're in a group. And if we don't make a substantial reduction in PHOS, what's the point? I mean, this is when we start taking a lot of hatchery fish, it's really going to hurt the sports guys upriver. That's the fish they want, too. And we've got a lot of other groups like Wild Fish Conservancy heavily involved. They seem to be controlling the narrative. They're going around and selling this concept to people that don't understand. I mean, everybody's looking for a magic bullet to save the salmon, and it's not an easy one. And I really am skeptical that this is going to wind up being a usable, on large scale, usable tool that reduces PHOS, because there's a whole lot of other interests there that it works against. So this is a difficult problem. I think that we need to, for one, take control of the narrative, and you as a commission need to emphasize the purpose. And it's going to be very costly in the amount of fish harvested if you're going to make a substantial reduction in that PHOS. So anyway, that's all I have. Thank you.
Comments.
I'd just like to make one comment.
Go ahead, Robert.
When the possibility of using tangle nets was initiated in 2001, within a year we were using tangle nets. We recognized that they were going to be, give us a chance to harvest a reasonable number of fish, and they worked within the economics of our businesses, and we added the recovery boxes. We didn't stall on an alternative gear, and that's an alternative gear. We were quick to adopt it. But when the economics aren't there, when there's no indication that we're going to be able to harvest fish or in a reasonable quantity, then there's less incentive to adopt these things. Commercial fishermen worldwide adopt new methods regularly when it fits their goals of running a business and harvesting fish for the public. And we have a record of doing that, too. And this alternative gear conversation is not directed towards that sort of a result, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.